Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Albion's Seed, British Folkways in North America, this week on Soundings. My guest is David Hackett Fisher of Brandeis University. David Fisher's new book, Albion's Seed, was published last year by Oxford University Press. Albion's Seed examines four principal migrations from Britain to North America: East Anglia to Massachusetts, the south of England to Virginia, the North Midlands to the Delaware Valley, and the British borderlands to the backcountry of the North American continent. In his discussion of these transitional patterns, David Fisher seeks to synthesize historical methods and interpretive perspectives in the creation of what he calls an idea of cultural history. All right, now, would you use a term like melting pot when you bring all of these together? That I take it, is a sort of an old-fashioned way of looking at this synthesis that you're after.
Yes, I don't think in terms of melting pots. I think
I've heard that criticized by historians, that really is not only unfashionable, it is just plain inaccurate.
Well, that's my view.
Tell me about that.
That these groups did not melt. They did not merge into one another.
They retained.
And the four folk cultures established a kind of regional hegemony, each of them, and gave those regions a set that they've preserved ever since, even as people of many different ethnic backgrounds have moved in. Very few people today in America are British in their origins and their ancestry. Less than 20%.
In contrast to what?
Well, in as late as 1790, it would have been about 70%, 60 to 70%. And even into the late 19th century, it was half or so. So a big change in the ethnic composition of this country. But as people came in, the new immigrants came in, they didn't assimilate American culture in general. They assimilated the culture of a region. So when the Kennedys came to Massachusetts, even as they remained fiercely Irish and Catholic, they learned to be New Englanders, and John Kennedy would say America in Cuba, and those are East Anglian pronunciations.
Yeah, those appear to be trivial kinds of things, but they're not really.
But they're indicators of a much deeper web of culture, of value, of belief.
What do you mean, David Fisher, by a term such as the determinants of a voluntary society? I take it that is one of the elements that brings not only these four folkways together, well, separates them as well as brings them together, and then creates for you a number of categories.
Yes. A voluntary society was a pedantical way of saying us, really. Right. What I meant was a world that's democratic, I mean majoritarian, that's capitalist in its economy, that's individualist in its society, that's libertarian in its laws, and that's pluralistic in its culture. I think that's what America is. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how did we get that way? What are the determinants of that system?
Well, in these numerous ways, quote-unquote, that you cite in your book, Albion Seed, gender ways, family ways, wealth ways, social ways, there's, as I say, a couple of dozen of them. Are they democratic? Are they egalitarian? Do they all operate at...
No, not at all. Not necessarily.
How do you rank them?
Well, I would say that the most democratic of these folk cultures were the Quakers, pretty much. The least so were the Virginians. But what created a kind of basis for an opening society was the fact that there were four of these cultures. And when they came together to form a nation, none of them could have everything its own way. And so the result was a kind of opening system. Strong parallels in the English language that all of them, nearly all of them, spoke, in British laws, in a sense of British liberties. But then they did so many things differently. They the ordinary things of life. They raised their children differently. They named them differently. They organized their families in different ways. They ate different foods. They played different games. And then beyond that, they did the most serious things differently. They worshipped differently. Hmm. They had different ways of organizing their politics.
And I take it that you, when you say different, you don't mean better or worse. You mean it on its own terms.
I mean different. Yeah. And they did little things and big things differently. Some things I didn't put in my book. For example, they had different ways of dealing with wolves and foxes, a major problem in the environment. The Puritans went after the wolves and foxes in the most implacably Puritan way. They exterminated them systematically.
Yeah.
The gentlemen of Virginia made a blood sport of it. Mm-hmm. They caught wolves as a game. People in the backcountry caught wolves in hollow logs and crawled in and challenged them to single combat. And the Quakers,
David Crockett.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And the Quakers tried to be friends with the wolves. Uh-huh. So we can see in so many different ways.
What about the treatment of the American natives themselves?
Very different. And the Puritans regarded the Indians as one of the lost tribes of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to convert them. Treated them with great fairness and insisted that no individual could buy land from the Indians, mm-hmm. controlling it in a very systematic way.
And yet
way.
There was a lot of racism, was there not?
There was indeed. And when the Indians resisted conversion.
You're going to be good on my terms.
That's right. The Virginians regarded Indians as gentlemen of another culture. The ancestor of the historian Edward Gibbon was a student of heraldry. And he came to America and he observed that the Indians had their own heraldry on their shields and in their war paint. And that convinced him that they were really gentlemen, much like the Gibbons of England.
Doesn't Mark Twain transfer this into black culture and the...
Very much so, very much so.
The Old South?
And the Quakers had a sense of all of God's children living in harmony.
What about food?
Together.
Let's talk. I don't want you to give me recipes necessarily, but what about some of these parallels?
There's been a very interesting study that was done in England, commissioned by owners of grocery stores to find out what people ate in Britain. The question was, what should be stocked in grocery stores? And the answer was that grocery stores needed to be stocked in different ways in different parts of England. The short of it is that people in the east of England tend to bake more than other people do.
Uh-huh.
People in the south of England fry. And people in the north of England boil.
Here we have the origins of the 7-Eleven, huh?
I think that's exactly right. That the oven becomes a very important folk artifact in New England.
What about medicine and health? Was there one of these British folkways that appeared to produce a healthier people than another?
There was a great difference that way, but I think it came more out of the American environment. It was more a matter of diseases in the New World than it was the medicine that was practiced.
How about education? Did one tend to produce a livelier, more educable child than another?
They went four ways here again, and the New Englanders wanted both strong primary schools and good colleges. The Virginians wanted colleges for the elite, but they didn't want primary schools.
Hmm.
The Quakers wanted primary schools, but they didn't want colleges, and were the last Christian denomination to found them.
What about our captains of industry? Where did they come from? Do you trace that to one particular British folkway?
Well, I think there is a great truth in the Protestant, in the idea of a work ethic.
Uh-huh. Donald Trump, are you going to find him back there?
No, I think he appears
all by himself
a little bit later. I see New York as a very different world preserves another sort of culture from the past. The Dutch created a kind of cultural web was defined in Netherlands, in Amsterdam, a city of great cultural diversity and yet a great official tolerance but strong tensions between the groups. And this comes to New York City. In Old Amsterdam, in New Amsterdam, in the taxi drivers of Manhattan today, one sees an extraordinary persistence of a world in which ethnic groups are very tightly bonded amongst themselves, but intensely hostile to people of other ethnic groups.
The tribe and the clan.
Very much like that. And the public manner of New York today, a kind of cultivated rudeness beyond the ethnic group.
Yeah, but they're working on
that. They are, but they have no idea, I think, how of the historical baggage that they have to unpack to deal with all of that.
David Fisher, what about sexual mores?
Is
it possible to look way back in American history and say, here we find the origins of what we call the sexual revolution in the 20th century?
Well, I think that one can see differences in attitudes towards sex in New England. Attitudes were not puritanical in the popular sense, but the Puritans strongly favored sex as an important bond in marriage, even as they put really tight restrictions on sex outside of marriage. And they were very even-handed about punishing sexual deviance. Men and women both were punished with very near equality. In the South, things were very different. In Virginia, the sex outside of marriage was, as though officially condemned, was widely tolerated and practiced with very high rates of prenuptial pregnancy. And for offenses such as bastardy, women were punished with extreme severity.
In the South?
In the South, and men scarcely at all.
Uh-huh.
The backcountry was the most relaxed about sex, and
enforce the rules.
Well, I think they were comfortable with a kind of sensual conception of sex that others resisted, the Quakers most of all. They were the most austere and ascetic, some even arguing that there should be no sex within marriage except for procreation.
Right.
And that was the extreme.
What about spiritual ways? Is there, as you trace these four British folkways, David Fisher, what do you find in terms of good, better, best differences in terms of spiritual life?
Well, differences that we think sometimes were created in America, but in fact came from Britain.
The old country.
Classic example is the camp meeting, which a generation of American historians thought was invented on the frontier. But there were open field meetings, called field meetings, in fact, in North Britain, very common in the early 18th century.
All right, and this would have not only a spiritual dimension, but a political one as well.
That's right, and are institutions that become very important to the entire web of culture in the backcountry.
Entertainment, recreation?
Very much so. As to sports, New Englanders invented ordered sports, team sports, played with the ball. They invented, really, popularized American football, as we understand it.
Uh-huh.
And baseball was first played. These were called the New England game, the town game. The people of Virginia had a very different idea. Sport in Virginia meant blood sports. Jefferson speaks with contempt of games played with the ball. And on the other hand, in the backcountry, the sports ran more to tests of strength, individual strength and courage, which became in the 19th century Caledonian Games, as they were called, from North Britain, and today are the ancestor of track and field. There's a direct line there. The Quakers liked what they called useful and diversions, and that meant things such as gardening and walking and skating, and all of these forms of entertainment took on a certain set.
David Fisher, tell me about the interplay in your book, Albion Seed, between the little people and the big people.
That's very important to what I'm doing.
You know, you're looking, you mentioned Jefferson, for instance. How much would you look at an individual like that in contrast to somebody whose name that we don't know, but who may in fact be very representative of the way people lived?
Yes. Historians have gone two ways. The old political historians were centered on the on elites. Mm-hmm. The new socialist Aryans wanted to talk about ordinary people.
Mm-hmm. And what do you
And the cultural history I'm trying to do brings them together. I think we're discovering ways in which what historians call high culture and vernacular culture, that is ordinary culture, are very closely linked and in several ways, so that what we think of as folkways are often not inherited from the distant past alone, but are constantly changing in motion. And the changes are often the work of cultural elites.
Yeah, let's not freeze the past back there. Let's make it fluid and connect it to the present.
Yes, and I think it's the case that, well, for example, the founders of these regions, Sir William Berkeley, played a formative role. William Penn, in his intentions, and George Fox before him, laid out a conception of a culture in Pennsylvania that was really a blueprint for a world that in large measure developed there, much more so than historians, I think, mm-hmm. often think. It was the same with the Puritans and even in the backcountry.
Right. Tell me about the historical enterprise over the past 25 years and the way these developments have affected the writing of this book.
Well, we've been through a couple of generations in the 20th century. About three generations ago, history was mainly about politics. It was about the past, and It produced narratives that still appear in most of our textbooks. Then there was a revolution about the mid-1960s, and young historians then developed what they call the new social history. Mm-hmm. And they had high hopes. They thought that that was not merely to be a new subdiscipline of history, but it was the discipline itself in a new form.
Yeah, they were going to change not only the doing of history, but the way history affected living in the present.
That's right. And for them, history was not about the past, it was about change, past and present in a kind of mutual perspective. They had very large plans. They talked of something which they called histoire totale, the history of everything.
Right.
And
was this arrogance? How would you characterize that? Did you participate in this?
I did, yes. It wasn't that at all. It was a sense of liberation. Uh-huh. It was a sense of breaking clear from a frame that seemed very, very confining. And I remember reading a memoir of a Civil War general who was described as having been so excited in the battle that he mounted his horse and rode off in all directions. And that's what the new social historians did. Fernand Braudel, who was one of the founders and patrons of all of this, said...
Frenchman.
Yes. Much of this came from France. It really grew from a Gallic root. And Braudel said that the new history was overwhelmed by its own success.
Mm-hmm.
And so recently, history's been fragmenting into lots of special
fields. Yeah, you got women's history, you got the history of this, that, and the other.
Yeah, and those historians only talk to historians of their own specialty. There's a sense that that's not as it should be, that actually all of these historians, all the various specialties, share general problems and interests in common.
All right, now the word synthesis, I hear this hovering over the table here, and that figures in your book.
So I was looking for a way to put the pieces together, as a great many other people are as well, and that led me to an idea of cultural history. It's cultural in an anthropological sense, really. It's a history of American folkways.
Is this a dangerous thing for you to do, to incorporate the methods, if not the aims, of another discipline? Do your colleagues in history look upon you as a rebel?
I think historians have been so shell-shocked by all this that they're prepared to be more tolerant of other borrowings. And I think actually most historians respond positively to this idea, that is, to putting the pieces together, mm-hmm. and even to doing it in kind of a cultural frame.
All right, now you're looking at origins, cultural origins.
Yes.
I sit here wide-eyed and I say to you, why are you interested in where it all began? So what?
Well, I think that that's only one set of questions, but it's the first question. And I did I set up a series of volumes, each about a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the problem of origins was the one to begin.
All right, now that's Albion's Seed.
That's Albion's Seed, yes. And it had a kind of, it had a slow beginning in my own thoughts, really. I was traveling in England coming from New England, where I live, and seeing striking similarities in the countryside, mm-hmm. and some of the records that I was reading, and that set my mind in motion. And then another part of it came from a map, which I wish I could show the listeners. It's a map of American speechways. It shows one major indicator of culture here. And what it shows is that basically there are four major speech regions in America.
We are what we talk.
We have to talk about most of the things that we are, so that it's a good way of getting into it. Uh-huh. And I began to find that as a way of seeing four different cultures on this side of the water. Mm-hmm. My question was, where did they come from? And as I started searching in England, I found a set of patterns over there that matched.
All right, now we're back in a way to not only the origins in cultural terms, but the origins in historical terms. You have recourse to a couple of models: the frontier thesis, the germ thesis,
yes.
the migration thesis.
Yes.
Tell me how those considerations entered into what you call these four British folkways.
Well, when historians think about our origins, they tend to run to two or three major ways of major lines of thought. One is to the question is, how did our culture develop? Many historians looked back to some sort of European baggage that was brought here. Other historians in the late 19th, early 20th century said, no, that's wrong. We should look to the American environment. The classical example is the Turner thesis.
All that space.
The frontier, empty land, free land, was the idea. And then was followed by a third answer to the question in the mid-20th century by historians who said, no, that's wrong too, that what makes us what we are is our diversity. It's the immigration process. Mm-hmm. It's the multiplicity of ethnic groups. And it's what historians call a Madisonian idea of American history, that is to say, a conception of an open society that's sustained by its ethnic pluralism.
Mm-hmm. Does one of these tend to dominate, or how do you mix them up? No, I mean in your work here
well,
in Albion State.
In my work, I'm going back to the first, to the European cultures, uh-huh. but within the framework of the second and the third.
The germ thesis.
Something like that, yeah. But I'm arguing that, in fact, there were many cultures that were brought here. Mm-hmm. And what I was looking for was a way of writing history, thinking about history, which avoids both antiquarianism on the one side.
Antiquarianism, just give me a footnote on that.
That the past has nothing to do with the present,
it's
really.
It's back there.
It's removed from the present.
Yeah.
And presentism on the other, the idea that the past is prologue to the present.
Uh-huh. Does that mean repetition? Does that mean prediction?
It means that I think people who would be presentist would go back and look into a past world for the things that are part of our world and only those things. Hmm. And most historians quite rightly object to that. They say that's to falsify the world that was, which had an integrity in its own right. Mm-hmm. So what I'm looking for is a way of studying history without the errors of antiquarianism on the one hand or presentism on the other. Hmm. The object is really to see the past in its own terms, with the kind of integrity that culture had, but at the same time to see that culture in relation to the present. That is, these two worlds have connections and very complex relationships. And for me, the main thing is that we today live in a historical continuum. We're part of our mm-hmm. history, and our history makes us what we are, and we make history.
What does this book have to do with all that we hear today about the cultural canon, our cultural inheritance, the teaching of, quote, American values and the transmission of cultural and moral values from one generation to another? Is that part of your
That's
purpose?
A very large part of my purpose. I have the feeling that a great many people who write American history in the universities today are fundamentally hostile to the society that they're studying. They object to its economics. They distrust its politics. and they're very uncomfortable in its society.
I take it that you're not.
And no, I'm not. I think that some things have gone profoundly right in this world. And I frankly celebrate a system which holds to the rule of law.
Let me put a footnote question to you here, David Fisher. Why do you want to be remembered as a historian? Is there a particular thing that you take special pride in this series of books that you have written and that you are writing now, a particular goal that you bring to this work?
Well, I think mostly, for me, it's a matter of trying to put the pieces together in a way that that makes sense and open still other possibilities for thought, reflection. It seems to me that we are constantly engaged in a kind of dialogue between past and present. I think it's the job of the historian to help that process, fertilize that process, keep it growing and growing richer through time.
All right, and a final footnote. Are you going to be accused of being a Freudian historian?
No, that's
you've got
one
this
complaint.
Title,
that's
Albion's
not,
seed.
No, that's I've not not been. You know, that's one complaint that's not been made of all this. This centers more on consciousness than on the unconscious, and it really is. Walker Percy said that. After I think 5 years in analysis, he thought that Freud had it wrong. He didn't understand that we are masters of our thoughts, and I think Walker Percy had it right.
David Fisher teaches at Brandeis University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. David Fisher is the author of Albion's Seed, published last year by Oxford University Press. Another interview featuring David Fisher appears in the November 1990 issue of American Heritage. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Please ask for program number 523. That's program number 523. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Lawrence Friedman of Bowling Green State University will discuss his new history of the Menninger Psychiatric Clinic. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week brings us El Día de la Raza, a celebration in Mexico of the cultural heritage of Spanish and Indian peoples and the Hispanic nations. The first week in October marks an anniversary for the ceremony in 1867, transferring the ownership of Alaska from Russia to the United States. Birthdays this week include the musicians Yo-Yo Ma, Heinrich Schütz, John Lennon, and Luciano Pavarotti. The politicians, Margaret Thatcher, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Jesse Jackson. The scientist, Benjamin Banneker. The aviator, Eddie Rickenbacker. The writers, Imamu Amiri Baraka and James Whitcomb Riley. The literary forger, Thomas James Wise. And the explorer, Thor Heyerdahl. Happy birthday also this week to the White House, the cornerstone for the presidential residence at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the District of Columbia, was put into place in early October 1792. Finally, just 10 years ago this week, the first edition of this radio program was broadcast on half a dozen stations around the country. Soundings is now heard regularly on more than 260 outlets nationwide. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. British Folkways in America, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with David Hackett Fisher of Brandeis University. David Fisher is the author of Albion's Seed, Four British Folkways in America, the first in a series of books on American cultural history. Albion's Seed, Cultural Patterns in Transition, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.